Welcome to Down Home Radio. On today's show, I speak with Robert Crumb. Crumb is best known as a cartoonist and illustrator, but what a lot of people don't know about him is that he is a very talented old-time mandolin player. He also plays the guitar and the ukulele, and is a very serious collector of 78 RPM records. I caught up with Robert Crumb at the home of John and Eden, who are known as the East River String Band, a wonderful old-time and blues band. We met up over at their apartment on the Lower East Side in Manhattan. We had a good talk about Crumb's interest in the old music and his early experiences finding old vintage 78 RPM records, often in the same junk shops where he searched for comic books when he was a kid. And we talk about his experiences collecting records and meet a lot of interesting personalities. Go to strange places, oftentimes interesting places, searching for the old records, all the way from here in the United States down to his most recent searches for amazing music, which we'll play a bunch of on the show, from South America, Argentina, and Uruguay. And Robert Crumb plays live on the air with the East River String Band. And as usual, I would like to thank our good friends over at the Old Time Herald magazine. The Old Time Herald is the source for news and reviews and everything about old time music. It's a wonderful, wonderful publication, and I'm a subscriber of many years, so I once again would recommend the Old Time Herald magazine. Check them out on the web, oldtimeherald.org, and you can subscribe there on the website. So let's get right down to the interview with Robert Crumb. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you very much for being on the program.
My pleasure.
And I'd like to start out by asking you when and how you first got interested in old music.
Well, when I was a kid, I was always attracted to old music and watching old movies on TV. Hal Roach comedies, Laurel and Hardy, Little Rascals. The music in those really grabbed me deeply for some reason. Don't know why. I think it's neurological, some quirky types of nervous systems are just attracted to that old music. And I couldn't find it. This was in the 1950s. I couldn't find it on modern records. I didn't understand that. It wasn't clear. Nothing was clear. I didn't know anybody that knew anything. Nobody else was interested. And
you're from Pennsylvania?
I just moved around. This was in Delaware when I actually started in my teens actively looking for this music on records. And LPs, I picked up these LPs that were like 1920s kind of reproductions of 1920s music, and it was all hoked up. It wasn't right some. It didn't sound like the same as the music in the old movies, like early 30s movies. Yeah. And then I was collecting comics, and I used to look in junk stores and secondhand stores for comics, and I noticed there were 78s there. So one day I brought these 78s home, and I had, you know, in those days all record players had 78 speed and everything, and I played these 78s, and this one record from 1928 just struck me. That's it. That's the music I've been looking for. I was 16. All my life I've been looking for that music. It's on these on these old 78s. This was dance band music. It wasn't country music or blues or anything. It was just 20s dance band music. And that was the first area that really attracted me, because that was the only music that I was exposed to at all from old movies on TV. Right. I never, ever exposed to old country music, old blues, anything like that. Never heard it.
When did you finally start hearing that stuff?
Well, you know, once I started collecting 78s, and I became really obsessed with them, because I was just this nerd outcast in, you know, high school and everything. I had nothing else to do, and since I wasn't part of the teenage scene, I no longer had to pretend to like modern popular music. So then I started finding all kinds of strange records. I didn't know anything. There was no books telling you what anything was, you know, so you just pick up everything. It was cheap, you know, 10 cents, a quarter at junk stores. Mostly in those days, it was secondhand stores. And where I lived in Delaware, there was big rambling old buildings that full of old stuff going back into the 19th century that nobody cared about. Yeah, it was interesting. I also was still looking for old books and everything.
So this was the 50s. There was like pop. There was like pop folk on the radio. Early 60s. Did you relate that? Did you relate the pop folk stuff that maybe you heard on maybe on the radio to the music that you were discovering?
No, not at all. This is 1959, 60, 61. In that period, this is my last few years of high school is when I really got into it, collecting these old records. And then I connected with a couple other guys from Ohio that were collecting old jazz. And they kind of hipped me to some places, to some reading material, and, you know. And I even got into subscribing to the a magazine called The Record Research. Just this little cheaply printed thing. Then they had lists of records that you could bid on auction. So I started doing that. And first I was really fixated on this old dance band music and then kind of branched into jazz. But then I started finding these old blues records and country records too. And at first they sounded so strange to my ear. They were so exotic and foreign. I didn't even know whether I liked them or not at first. And I found this book called Jazzmen that came out in 1939, in which there was a chapter called Hot Collecting, and they talked in there about guys who went door to door in black neighborhoods in cities like Philadelphia, St. Louis, Cincinnati. And so I thought, I'll do that here in Dover. It was in Dover, Delaware. And then I would go in these people's houses, and they'd have old Victrolas, you know, these old couples, and stacks of 78s. They're all beat up, usually, of these blues records, and some even odd and unusual territory race records of jazz bands and stuff. All the names were completely strange and unknown and exotic to me, all this stuff. And there was no references even in the book Jazzmen. They just talked about Duke Ellington, Vic Spiderbeck, Fletcher Henderson, all the well-known names in jazz. They didn't talk about this obscure stuff at all. And the only blues mentioned was Bessie Smith and that sort of thing. There was nothing about Charlie Patton or the Two Poor Boys, any of that. And I just went from there, just got deeper and deeper into it from there.
What's maybe a track that we could play now on the show, something that maybe you heard early on that really grabbed you?
Play Shook It Up This Morning by Joe Evans. Boy, did that grab me. Wow.
Come at 12 o'clock, got need to shake it up right. So now if I could holler, just like a mountain jack. So now if I could holler, mama, just like a mountain jack. I would crawl up on some mountains, holler for my woman back. Two kind of people, baby, I can't understand. Just two kinds of people I can't understand. A four-legged woman likes a knock-kneeded man. Bet your life, one's got the other's man. Hard luck them come here, call me Annabelle. Hard luck them come here, call me Annabelle. I ain't even got no friends,
even got no gal. I gotta rock my pillow, she don't find my bed. I gotta rock my pillow, she don't find my bed. I ain't got no way, lay my way ready.
That's on like cheap dime store labels. I think it's 1931. Shook it up this morning. Play that one.
And that's something that you found in a junk shop?
Well, when I went door to door in the black section of town, and people were very nice, you know, mostly. There were a couple. Some people were suspicious of the white boy coming around there looking, what was he doing there? You know, they didn't think I was just looking for records. They didn't know what I was doing. But then I ran into this guy hanging around the corner, this little old black guy, and he said that he cleaned basements and stuff for a living, and he often came across 78s, and he would let me know. He said, come around, I'll let you know. And so this one time he had this whole stack of, they were all pretty beat up, of really unusual records of blues and jazz from that period, of, and that Two Poor Boys, or Joe Evans was one of those. And,
unbelievable.
Yeah.
You'd also play them Happy Days and Lonely Nights. Can you tell me that was the first one you
that
ever
was
found?
The first one that struck me, yes. Happy Days and Lonely Nights by Charlie Fry's Million Dollar Pier Orchestra from Atlantic City, 1928. It's the penultimate 20s dance band record.
Unbelievable.
I don't think it's ever been reissued anywhere.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
Very.
But you have it. So.
Yes, I do. It's one of the early records I found, too.
Yeah.
My heart a million ways when you took my happy days and left me lonely nights. Thank you.
why do you think it is that, that you related so strongly to this sort of archaic and even foreign sounding music at that time?
I have no idea. But you know, this was 1960 and the music was only 30 years old then, and it seemed as strange and antique then as it does now. You know, it's funny. This music had come so far from that in the 30 years since that stuff was recorded. By 1960, you know, the music business was in full flower and everything was slick and commercial. Country music, country western, rock and roll, mainstream, middle of the road pop music. It was also in Broadway show music. My sister liked Broadway show music. I used to play those records every day, Rodgers and Hammerstein and the West Side Story and South Pacific. I hated it so much. It was unbearable. But all those tunes are burned into my brain because my sister would just play them every day in her bedroom, you know. She had her record player. I had my record player. I'd listen to my old weird 78s, and my siblings all just thought it was weird that I liked this old 78s.
Did you get into any of the, like, you know, folk revival or whatever stuff in the 60s, any of those players?
By the time I left home and I went to Cleveland, I got involved with these college kids. I didn't go to college myself, and they were all into that folknik scene, Joan Baez Judy Collins and all this stuff. To me, I'd already was steeped in
Judy
the
Collins
old music by then.
Folk?
Yeah. To me, it was already, I just saw it as lame. Bob Dylan, I just couldn't stand him. You know, they just,
How about, like, super traditionalist types, you know?
Well, the super traditional stuff was, in fact, that there were still a lot of people still living that had played in the 20s and 30s, so...
Did you catch some? You caught some of them?
Yeah, you could go and catch Jesse Fuller or even Mississippi John Hurt at the local folk club. They'd come through there. They did the circuit for a while, you know? So, yeah, I saw some of those people, and that was always a great pleasure to see that, you know? See the real thing in person, you know. But
none of the young
white people doing it. John Hammond Jr. Boy, was that guy embarrassing? Oh, Jesus, doing his Robert Johnson thing. pretty embarrassing. Yeah, yeah. It's funny nowadays. It's ironic here. Just like 50 years later or whatever. Those young kids would sound more authentic and old time than those folk Nixon-esque in the 60s. You know, that band that you play in is much more authentic and down to earth and real than, you know, those bands in the 60s. It's funny. Funny thing.
Just the passage of time, more objectivity in some way?
I think it's actually, you're so far removed from the original that you have to go back and really listen to the 78s. So you're listening to the 78s from the 20s, and you're hearing the real music much more. You're much more steeped in it than those people were in the 60s.
And now you can hear these records, where back then, you know, it's probably much more difficult to hear. I mean, I think this generation, the kids I hear coming up, you know, it's amazing to me. They'll say stuff like, oh, yeah, the Swamp Rooters. And it's like, how do you know that? Well, it's on Times than what I used to be. That's right.
You're
absolutely
right.
These people never had access to the really good stuff.
The only thing around in 1961, 62 that had any reissues of old-time white music was that Harry Smith anthology.
Right.
It's the only thing.
That was it.
And a lot of people thought that was all the interesting white country folk music that had been recorded back then. So people just assumed that that was it. That was all there was.
I still get comments sometimes when Eden and I play. Like, every once in a while, someone comes up to me like, oh, I love your band. It's like that Harry Smith record. I'm like, you know, that's the only reference where I can't go like, well, no, not exactly. I mean, it's kind of general, but, you know, you say, yeah, well. Yeah, that's what we're trying to do.
What can you say, you know? What are you going to do? Go into the whole spiel, you can't do it. Yeah.
No, John does it.
I used to try, but
now
I just accept whatever they say. They say, oh, I love you guys, bluegrass. I go, yeah, me too. I love bluegrass.
Yeah, you're wasting your breath trying to make distinctions and, you know, go into detail about it. Yeah.
Well, what's another record that we could hear now on the show that you like?
Should pick out one of those territory jazz bands you talked about, but you people have never heard that stuff.
Play Eddie and Sugar Lou's Hotel Tyler Orchestra doing KWKH Blues. Play that.
KWKH blues. I got the KWKH, KWKH blues. So just tune in, baby, while Daddy sings these blues to you.
I got that record. I couldn't believe it. Who the hell is Eddie and Sugar Lou? There's nothing, no place written about that at all.
Yeah. Where'd you find that?
That was one of those records. That guy on the corner in Dover, Delaware, that cleaned basements.
Oh yeah, you told me about that.
Sounds
like a fantasy world.
And Louis Dumain's Jazzola 8 came up with that one. Mm-hmm. And then my friend Marty Pauls from Kent, Ohio, was a college student and a very slick kind of guy, good talker. When he found out I was finding records like that in Delaware, he came there and traded me LPs for them. He gave me reissue LPs of, you know, Fletcher Henderson and stuff for those.
For the original 78s.
Yeah.
What were you thinking?
Well, he said, look, you've got 12 tunes on the LP, and this is only two sides, so, and I, okay. I didn't know. I had no clueless. I was like,
yeah,
you know, 17 years old.
I don't know how rare that stuff is.
No.
What you got.
No,
I didn't.
When did you start playing the mandolin? Or when did you start playing instruments? What was your first instrument?
Well, when I was 12 years old, I got a plastic ukulele for Christmas. So I really wanted to play music. And it came with a little booklet, Arthur Godfrey's Ukulele Lessons. So by the end of the first day, I could play, you know, three-chord melody. I thought, wow, amazing. So then I went from there to a plastic banjo. Because, you know, they were cheap instruments. And there was nobody in my family that was interested in this at all. Although my grandfather had been a musician back in the early 1900s. He played in vaudeville theaters in Philadelphia and was in those Philadelphia string bands and all. He played banjo and mandolin and all that. But he was dead. He died in 44. I was a year old. And my mother's generation, none of her and her brothers, none of them carried it on. And amazingly, recently, I asked John to look for old copies of Metronome from the 20s and 30s because they have all kinds of interesting little information about bands and stuff in those days. And he sent me this 1931 Metronome. I'm looking through it. And there's a picture of my Uncle Frank Jackson with his banjo in there in 1931. And this little blurb about how I had this dance orchestra in Philadelphia. Nobody in my family ever said anything about that. They were not interested in that. It was out of their radar completely. Yeah, amazing. So I played these plastic instruments. Later I found that these instruments were made by this company run by this guy, McAferry, who was a French classical guitar player.
Yeah,
and he came to America. Yeah, and post-war era, plastic was the thing, and he made these actually quite well, serious, well-made plastic instruments.
Yeah,
that
they were real instruments. They weren't toys. Yeah.
Somebody I know, Armstrong, has a plastic McAferry archtop guitar.
Yeah. I saw that.
A full-size guitar. It's like white plastic on top with brown on the back. It's actually playable. It frets properly and everything. A really shitty sound quality, but I had this red plastic tenor banjo when I was 13, 14 that I played and strummed. I took it to school once. Says the music teacher, "Is anybody in the class playing an instrument?" I said, "Yeah, I play the banjo." "Well, bring it in. Let's hear it." So I brought it in. I played like I've been working on the railroad, strummed and sang that. And the rest of the kids just looked at me like, "What a nerd! What a out of it square!" You know, I was just held in total contempt. And that was the era of Bobby Rydell and Elvis and all that stuff. So
you were square, man.
Scorned instrument I was playing there.
You must have been able to find good instruments at like yard sales and junk stores.
I wasn't hip to it at all. Wasn't hip to it. Instruments. No. Not until I moved to San Francisco when I was in my early 20s, and then I had no money. I bought a $3 banjo uke at the flea market, and I played that for like 10 years. I played this cheap $3 banjo uke from the 20s that had like little slogans written on it from the 20s.
And what about your mandolin playing? When did that start, and how did you start,
Like gradually, when I was in the Cheap Suit Serenaders starting in the early 70s, I found these other guys that liked old music, amazingly enough, and had real instruments and could play it. And Al Dodge, who was one of the Cheap Suit Serenaders, he was the first guy I got involved that played old music. And he said, "Look, Crumb, you got to get a real instrument. You can't just play this banjo uke, Get a tenor banjo." So he helped me find a decent tenor banjo. So for 10 years, I just strummed the tenor banjo in that band. And then I kind of learned to play the guitar and be able to strum chords on the guitar. I had a good ear for chords because it's all I did for first 20 years I played music. I was just play chords, and I kind of learned chord patterns and progressions just by ear, completely by ear. So I got good at that. So that was nice for guys who wanted to play lead. There's Crumb. He can strum. He can play all the chords for all the tunes. I could figure the chords out, without having to look at some written thing. So that was kind of the foundation of that band. So I gradually moved into the guitar, strumming the guitar, and then in the 70s, 80s, I gradually got into playing a mandolin. I got a cheap mandolin, a Wabash mandolin. And easy mandolin is the easiest instrument to learn. You just have to be able to press your fingers down. You have to get tough fingers because it takes a lot of pressure. I was teaching this woman I know to play the mandolin recently. She said, "Boy, these wires are really hard to press." I also have synesthesia. So I see all the chords as colors. They're all colors to me. C is blue, D is orange, A is yellow, E is red, F is kind of periwinkle, bluish purple.
You see that in your mind?
Yeah, it's just all automatic.
So instead of calling out keys, I should just call out colors. This one's in periwinkle.
F. Right. And B flat is kind of mauvish pink. As you get into the flats, it gets duller, more pastel. The sharps are brighter.
What's maybe a mandolin? I really admired your mandolin playing when we played the other night. I was wondering, what's a track that inspired you on the mandolin we could hear?
A mandolin track.
Elmer Byrd.
I love Elmer Byrd stuff. I love that really simple, it's beautiful style. Man, I aspire to that. Just really plain, straightforward mandolin style of Elmer Byrd. Any track by Elmer Byrd's band.
That's the name of just his name, or has he had a band?
Sometimes they're called the Kentucky Ramblers.
Oh, okay.
Those are good.
Ginseng Blues or something?
Yeah, great.
Dig no ginseng. Well, ain't gonna hunt no squirrel. Ain't gonna do a doggone thing but love my dear sweet mama. Oh, you can't leave my mind. When you think I'm gonna love you, mama, I'm putting you all the time. Yeah,
My home ain't here. It's down in Caroline. I got the killing down in Georgia, but they do ain't my sweet mama. Here's Gary in my mind. When you think I'm loving you, mama, I'm when you all of time. I got a girl in Georgia, one in Dixie too. If you dream of me, sweet mama, turn my back on you, good baby. You can't read my mind. When you think I'm gonna love you, mama, I'm putting you all the time. Ain't gonna love no fool. Put my head out the window, watch the drivers roll, sweet mama. You can't read my mind. When you think I'm gonna love you, mama, I'm when you all the time. A little lady,
wonderful. If I could just play like that, it's all I would aspire to. I'm not a virtuoso player by any means. I play backwards. I'm handicapped from the start. But I've been playing so long that that you know I got to have picked up something, some facility. And sometimes like I'm just amusing myself at home, I just pick up the mandolin and play. You know, I play really simple tunes. I don't try to do anything too complicated. Swanee River and old, you know, Oh Suzanne and Girl I Left Behind Me, stuff like that. I don't try to fancy ragtime stuff. Like Terry Zweigoff, his years of diligent practice, he can play some pretty fancy ragtime kind of stuff. I can't do that. It just takes a lot of practice.
Oh, I was wondering if you would tell me a little bit about your recent collecting activities. You've been to South America.
Yes. I got invited to South America to a festival, you know, to show my work and everything. But I probably wouldn't have gone except I had some leads from John Hennigan, in fact, on some record dealers in Argentina and Uruguay. So those things panned out to be gold mines. It was incredible. I spent so much money there, it was obscene on 78s, thousands of dollars on 78s. But
what was the situation like?
I'm sure it was once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So the guys were both really nice, really easy to deal with, both of them. The guy in Argentina in Buenos Aires, Rudy, he's an old guy, old school gentleman, you know. And he said, yeah, come out to the house, you know. So I went out there, and you know, there's rooms and rooms of records and books, and, you know, one of those kind of places, you know, incredible sheet music. Been collecting for 60 years, you know, and dealing as a dealer. But he says, mostly deals through the internet, and he used to deal through the mail. He said, hardly anybody has come to his house and looked through this stuff. He said, no, you're one of the few. So I'm looking through, and I'm just finding all these guitar records. And it was a big education, because I didn't know what a lot of it was. I didn't know much about the labels or the periods or anything, you know. You know, a little bit, just extrapolating from past experience with other places. But
what kind of style of music was this?
He said, most of what I have is tango. And I told him, I'm not interested in tango. He said, really? You come to Argentina, you're not interested in tango? I said, no, I want this guitar stuff. Because Hennigan had gotten all these records from through the mail, and the standard price was like $20 each, which, you know, where else are you going to find? He's already done the work of finding them, so, you know, it's worth it. And Hennigan sent me some that he duplicates, the guy had, and Rudy told Hennigan that he was his best customer for that stuff. So there's nobody even knows or is interested in this. It's incredible. It's the greatest guitar playing. It's so beautiful. And it's a very particular Argentinian gaucho, which is like their cowboy thing. Because, you know, that vast area of Argentina called the Pampas, which is this flat grassland of cattle raising. And so they had their own culture of ranching and cowboys, you know. Yeah, beef, Argentine beef, yeah. And then back then they developed this wonderful guitar playing. And there's this singing, too. The singing's okay. It's not, you know, for me as exciting as the guitars. And the big guy there, the guy that they all worship now, the kind of Bing Crosby of the era, was Carlos Gardel. And he's a very schmaltzy singer. I don't like him very much. And there's Carlos Gardel kitsch all over Buenos Aires, tango kitsch and Carlos Gardel. But some of his records have those guitars on them. Just beautiful. Sometimes there's three or four guitars. So, but there's other singers, more rough kind of down-to-earth singers I like better. But the guitars.
Yeah, what's the most down-home stuff that you have here that you
Well, there's these instrumentals that they do without the vocals. They're the greatest. Iriarte and these guys. Playing one of those Iriarte.
You can't go wrong. They're
all trio.
Playing that one.
Trio. Yeah, that's they're all masterpieces.
This stuff's unknown in North America. Unknown. I asked Rudy about that, and he says, well, there's a couple of guys besides you. That's it. And one of them is John Hennigan. It's incredible. Incredible. So he was happy to see. He kept, you know, when I was piling up, and he told me what the prices were, $20 each on average, and I kept piling up records. So he saw that. He started, you know, saw dollar signs. So he started just bringing out more stuff. He had this cart that he would wheel out with these boxes of 78s. That's right. And I spent 5 hours the first day going through records there, and then 3 hours another day. He said, yeah, come back again. I said, my wife won't let me come back. I've already spent so much money. So then I also had to go to Uruguay, 3 hours across the bay there by boat to Montevideo, and see Omar, who's a younger guy, but also really nice. And his scene was really interesting. It was in his house where he lived. And every room of his house with his wife and his mother-in-law, they all lived there. And every room had 78s stacked up all over the place in horizontal stacks, you know, which is not good for 78s to stack 3 feet of horizontally stacked 78s. So he had a lot of that. And, like, the mother-in-law's bed, I noticed, was in the dining room with a big TV where they watched soap operas. It was really interesting. I ate dinner with them, so I really got to sit down with a Uruguayan family, an ordinary lower middle class family. You know, he was making all his money off of dealing 78s and records, and he had a hustle, and he did it all on the internet. Again, I was one of the few people that ever showed up at his house to look through records, so I spent a day and a half there looking through records too, and piled, made another big pile. It's pretty much the same stuff that Rudy had, mostly Argentinian, but then there was also some Bolivian, Paraguayan, Chilean, whole other areas of music with these fabulous bands with fiddles and stuff in it. Bolivian stuff. Ooh, boy, it's fabulous music. It was thrilling, thrilling to find that stuff. Well, in the stuff that I'm going to send you to sell for me, there's some of there's duplicates of some of that stuff in there, Paraguay and stuff and all.
Sounds lovely.
Yeah, great music, wonderful music. But I couldn't find that. I was really interested in was Brazilian stuff. And Omar told me, you know, he thought maybe being in Uruguay, you know, it's closer to the Brazilian thing than Argentina. I thought maybe he'd have some. He didn't have. He had a couple of. He had some more recent Brazilian stuff that's not as interesting post-war, but he had only a couple of the earlier ones. I've got one guitar record that's great. Great guitar, Giacomino. Fabulous guitar playing from 1929. But I got to get back to Brazil and really find a dealer there. I'm sure there's a dealer in São Paulo. There's got to be. Or Rio, got to be.
Got to want it.
Yep.
I was wondering if you guys would maybe play a tune live for us on the show, if that's all right. If you guys got one.
Well, yeah, we could do that, I guess.
All right.
Sure. One, two, go!
Thank you, Greg.
When you hear me sing this song, baby ain't gonna be here long.
That was Eden and John's East River String Band with Robert Crumb. Thank you very much, guys. What is there another tune? You mentioned an Allen Brothers tune, maybe, or whatever you'd like to play.
High Patillion.
Let me get my uke.
What are you going to play for us now?
A song called High Patillion.
Or as I like to call it, Allen Brothers Rap.
Yes.
Thank you.
that's about the finest I ever heard.
That was beautiful. Thank
Pretty
you.
Nice.
I love that song.
You ever heard that record by Bob Miller's Hinky Dinkers on Brunswick called Practice Night at Chicken Bristle?
Yeah.
Right there. They play tunes and tell jokes. Yeah. It's one of the ones where the jokes are really funny, actually. Yeah. They're saying, okay, now let's play, you know, such and such a tune. One, two, go! And they just go right into the tune.
Hey, boys, you remember the night was all over at the Weavers, cutting up and playing and having such a good time?
Yeah, I remember.
You know, Abner and Cicero said to Alvira, said, we'd better go to bed. These boys might want to go home. Say, Mac, how's your brother Bub coming along?
Oh, he gets as honored as ever.
So you know, there's a boy, when you first meet him, you don't like him very well, but after you're with him a while, you can't hardly stand him. Ruth, you remember the other day when I passed you on the hill with my wagon and team?
Yep.
Well, as I was going up the hill there, that old horse of mine jumped and let one of the biggest and longest watermelon I had pull out of the wagon.
Well, let's play Walk Along John. Ready? One, two, one, two, go!
What you laughing at over there, Al?
This morning as I was coming down the road, well, I saw an old man getting up out of the road, and I asked him what was the matter. And he said, well, I fell out of my farm while I was going. It'll take me a half a day to get back.
Well, ain't nothing. Me and a bunch of boys are sitting out here under a shady tree yesterday. And there's an old fella come along and says, you boys want a job working out here on my farm? I spoke up right quick, and I said, is any land rolling? He said, yeah. I said, roll that part down here, then we'll work it for you.
Well, let's play Take in a Straw. Ready? One, two, go!
Bill, did you get that job you went after the other day?
No, I went down to see that feller and asked him could he use me, and he said yes, come back in the morning. So I told him I had a brother wasn't working and like to get him on too. He said, well, bring him down and I'll try him out. So I started home and happened to think about my dad. He wasn't working, and I went back and I says, mister, my dad's not a working and like to get him on too. And he says, can you do lots of work? And I says, Lord, yes. He says, well, send your dad down, you boys stay at home.
Say, fellas, let's play our favorite, Arkansas Traveler. Ready? One, two, go!
On to the place! Circle up! Swing that pretty girl behind you! On to the next! So she laid it go! On her swing! Rope town, don't tag me, your partner wants to have!
I guess I was wondering, when you lived in California, you were very involved in the counterculture there. Was what people sort of associate that with, like, rock and stuff. Did you meet any of those people, and did that sort of music, like, speak to you at all? Or
did not speak to me at all, no. I knew Janis Joplin and a few other people were involved in it, not very well. And I tried. I went to the clubs. I tried to like it. I went to the ballrooms, the Avalon, the Fillmore and stuff. It just put me to sleep. This noodling, endless psychedelic guitar solos and stuff was just a big yawn to me. It was terrible. These guys were terrible. And a lot of them had come out of the folk-nick scene, you know, Janis Joplin. I heard these tapes that she made in Texas in the earlier 60s where she's singing hillbilly music with the old-time country-style bands, and she was great. I think she was really naturally cut out to be one of those hillbilly shouters, you know. When she's doing that, so there's some tapes of her. They're around. You can hear them, you know.
How about like, yeah, that like 50s, 1950s, 1960s country music?
What I liked when I was like 13 was rockabilly, when that was going strong in like 56, 57 in there, 55. I like that. I liked early the Elvis's first stuff or Carl Perkins. There were a lot of them, a lot of crazy stuff, really crazy stuff in that rockabilly vein. I like that. I like that better than doo-wop or, you know, the kind of more sophisticated stuff that was coming out then. I didn't care for doo-wop much. I like rockabilly. But rockabilly faded from the airwaves. When I was young, when I was 13, I had this little cheap plastic radio next to my bed on the end table, and I used to tune these stations in from Memphis or places in the South that you could get where they play rockabilly. And then by 59, it was kind of gone. You couldn't hear it anymore.
Did it evolve?
I think it got suppressed. Rockabilly got suppressed. It was too dangerous and scary to the older generation. And all the older people that ran the big-time music business, the Mitch Millers and all them, they hated all that stuff. Frank Sinatra hated rock and roll. So they kind of tamed it. And the mafiosos got a hold of it in Philadelphia, and that Philadelphia sound became prominent for a while. Fabian and Frankie Avalon was awful, horrible. And there was still good stuff coming out of New York in the early 60s, the Four Seasons and stuff like that. I kind of like that. Big Girls Don't Cry and that kind of stuff. Sort of like that. To me, the last great rock and roll record is Tommy James and the Shondells doing My Baby Does the Hanky Panky. And then maybe Sam the Sham's Woolly Bully was kind of great. Real proletarian rock. And then the middle class took it over, and it just became pretentious and boring. And then you had the heavy metal and all that crap that came later. You know, Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and all that. I stopped even trying to like it. Metallica and all that crap. God, I don't know. It just all went to hell. But, you know, still back by the mid-60s, there was still some proletarian rock left. You know,
does that stuff have anything to do with the show tunes that you also didn't like in your mind?
It's music business, you know. It's contrived. It's all fucking contrived.
You can see what happens in the 30s when, you know, the commercialization of radio takes over the record business. Immediately the sounds change. For jazz and country, it's horrible. What they do to country is, like, inexcusable. It's just, it ends. Everything ends. You have to sound like one thing. You have, like, Bob Wills. Yeah, and that's it. And everybody's sound changes within a two-year period.
By the end of the 30s, yeah. It's pretty hard to find that Smith's Carolina Cracker Jacks becomes a real anomaly by the end of the 30s, you know.
Your friend.
But even in Argentina, I was going through those records at Rudy's and just listening to stuff because it was all new to me, you know, except for the few that I'd gotten from you and that you have. And so that I, you know, kind of got to know the labels and these ones from the late 30s. And by 1940, even there, you can start to hear it change. That gaucho thing gets slicker and more commercial, and it loses that raw edge to whatever it is. Who knows? It's hard to even put in words what it is, the authentic sound. It's, you know.
Just the watering down, you know, the commercialization of anything immediately takes all the soul out of it. They tell you how to sound. It'd be nice if you played, just don't be so intense. You know,
it happens gradually through those years in, you know, most places that I've heard records from, most places in the West, at least in the Western world. I don't know, maybe in Africa it hangs on longer. I have some 50s African records that are pretty deep, you know, the ethnic stuff.
Those guitar records, yeah. I just heard it,
yeah.
John Pango.
Oh my God.
In the 20s, yeah.
But
unaffected by the mass, you know, control of whatever it is, record companies, media.
Yeah. Yeah. Radio.
Just
totally
to do with
unaffected.
It.
Radio was big, important, yeah.
Well, is there maybe another recording that I could play to take out the show today? Some one last thing I should play?
I don't know. Raindrops Falling on My Head? I don't know. Jeez, I don't know. What do you think, John?
Playing
something strange. Something strange and exotic.
Strange and exotic.
Yeah.
Well,
think
maybe I'll play that Lou Paris Miranda bazillion record since you're speaking so much about
it. You have one?
Yes, I do.
Oh my God, he's got one of those Lou Paris Miranda records. Where'd you get that from? Sherwin or something?
Yes, I did.
Sherwin's the only guy in the U.S. that has that Brazilian stuff. There's one guy in the U.S. that has
Sherwin
that stuff.
Dunner.
Yep. He's the one guy that was enterprising enough to locate somebody in Brazil who would sell him that stuff.
Yep.
I'm sure he'd pay a lot for those, probably.
Well, thank you very much for being on Down Home Radio today. It was a pleasure.
Sure.